Recovering Queen. The Queen Fan Podcast, where we talk about and play the songs we love. With Jay, Matt, and Ian.
Welcome to Recovering Queen, a Queen Fan Podcast, where we take a famous or not so famous Queen track, do a cover version of it, and we talk about what we've learned about the methods and the madness of the greatest band there has ever been, Queen. My name's Ian, and with me, as ever, are Jay and Matt.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good morning.
Or good or afternoon.
Afternoon to our listeners who are listening when it's their afternoon.
This is an inclusive podcast.
Time zone independent. We honestly really don't mind what time of day you listen to this.
Even 3 a.m. What song are we doing on episode 16, Ian?
Son and Daughter, going right back.
Ooh, this is the first one we've done off Queen.
Indeed.
Which I think leaves us only News of the World Uncovered right now.
Oh, how did that happen? That's a travesty.
Yeah, I know.
Have we got a News of the World coming up?
I don't think we've decided, have we?
Come on then, Son and Daughter. Son and Daughter, you covered this one in.
Always surprises me that it's a May track. And I think it's the lyrics. They're so kind of, well, they're a bit kind of suggestive, aren't they, of somebody's sexuality that I just assumed in my head, wrongly, obviously, that it was a Mercury track. But it's clearly May.
Well, it does fit in with May's obsession with family. Son and daughter, father to son, sail away, sweet sister.
Yeah.
I mean, the surprise should be that he didn't write soul brother. Mm. Then he'd have the full ticket.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I guess it's the gender-bending lyrics, isn't it? I want you to be a woman, that kind of throws you that it's perhaps Mercury inspired.
See, I didn't read it like that. I read it as, I want you to be a woman. I don't want you to be like a woman pretending to be a man. You know, because at the time it was early 70s, wasn't it? And
feminism,
bra burning, all that sort of thing.
Yeah, I don't want you to be wearing dungarees. I want you to wear a miniskirt.
That's kind of what I was thinking, where he's coming from. But yeah, you might be right there. I don't know.
Yeah, I think the other words as well. That's didn't you feel surprised to find the cap just didn't fit? So I don't know. Again, is it a metaphor? Is it
no? But that's clearly about a contraceptive method, though, isn't it?
I'm not sure that that's clear. I don't think the lyrics are clear at all, because it seems to go from one theme to another. There's a sort of pseudo-religious theme, isn't there?
Yeah, there is, yeah.
What the hell is that about? Yeah. I mean, lyrically, it's all over the shop, but apparently it's one of Brian May's very earliest songs that he wrote at school.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
it is incredibly early. It's pre-John Deacon.
Yeah, well, it's actually the very first Queen song that John Deacon ever played. So it's what he played at the audition. So Brian gave him the chord sheet and said, "This is your audition, pal. Let's go." Yeah. And so he obviously smashed it, and the rest was history. So that was his introduction to the band. Not to move away from the lyrics just yet, because the lyrics are weird. Here's an explanation that I've read, and I don't think I buy it. I think it goes back to more the sort of thing that Jay, I'm sure, would agree, is that it's a pastiche of lots of different rock tropes. Mm. But some theories are that when Brian's mother lost a daughter before she was born, and they brought Brian up with this kind of pain of losing a daughter, treated him like he was a daughter. So he was a son and daughter rolled into one.
Interesting.
And it's his kind of rejection of that, but also rejection of teachers and things like that. You sort of telling you what to be. Mm. I don't want to be a woman. I want you to be a woman. It's very confused. I'm not quite sure what it is.
No.
Well, whatever the lyrics mean to you, that's fine. And it's more about the kind of music, because musically it contains a lot of Queen elements, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Roger Taylor comes in with his, "I want you to be a woman." It's straight in there, isn't it, with Queen harmonies stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Very, very high. Very difficult.
And of course, I suppose the most obvious thing to say about the musical direction is it's very rock, isn't it? It's very Deep Purple, very Led Zepp, I suppose.
Which was a criticism that was levelled at that first album quite widespread, wasn't it? That they're just another Led Zeppelin knockoff band. Mm. Obviously incorrect, but...
Yeah. Well, For me, I think it sounds most like Black Sabbath. I actually think that if you listen to that track, it's like if you put on the Black Sabbath album around that time, that's what it sounds like. I think that, and Brian May and Tony Iommi are friends, and I think now, so I think that Brian definitely did kind of look up to that kind of Iommi Sabbath era.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, particularly if it was written in 1970 as well, it is quite early, isn't it? Mm. And that was another problem that Brian's always had, that the amount of delays that album went under, wasn't it, to before it was released, like 3 years after it was recorded. So,
the Queen was delayed?
Yeah, absolutely. So they were recording using downtime at Trident, and then they signed up with Trident to try and get them a record deal, but they just couldn't. There was no significant interest, and hence the deal that eventually tied them up with management, record label, and publisher all through Trident. There was nobody that was willing to release it. So eventually it was released via EMI, but on a licensing deal. And that just, it took them years to get them from...
I didn't realise that. So what year did they start writing this then? What year were they in the studios? If this came out in 73, were they there in 71?
Well, they were performing it live in 1970, this track.
What, with Freddie?
First performance, Truro City Hall in June 1970.
Wow, yeah. Jeepers.
Yeah, really, really early.
This is recorded November 1972 was the recording date at Trident. So this is like one of the sort of later sessions that this song's recorded.
And then it was released the following year, wasn't it, in 73?
But they didn't do this song with Smile. If you think about, there was a couple of songs on Queen that were sort of doing the rounds with Smile beforehand.
Yeah.
Like doing All Right. So yeah, I guess, it's basically the songs are 3 years old and they really do sound dated as well, because rock is moving very, very fast at that point, isn't it? If you think about the albums that were coming out in 1970 and the albums that were coming out 73, studio technology is like massively advancing at that point. You go from bands that are lucky to record on stereo equipment to bands that are recording on multi-track equipment. Mm. So it's a big shift. And of course, Queen are at the forefront. If they're down at Trident doing this stuff as well, that's one of the sort of biggest studios there was at the time.
Yeah.
But how lucky are they that Trident's in-house producer is John Anthony and Roy Thomas Baker?
Absolutely.
I mean, because Roy Thomas Baker is their George Martin, isn't he, really?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
The other weird thing about this song is that it's not Vox AC30s as well. It still sounds like Brian, but it's Brian playing through Marshall amps. So it's got that kind of really fizzy.
Is that right?
Rather than the nice, glassy, smooth sort of Class A AC30 sound, it's got that kind of fizzy Marshall sound. But Freddie's loving it, isn't he? Because Freddie's like obsessed with Robert Plant. And so he's really gone for his kind of Robert Plant impression on it, on this song, I think.
Yeah.
So he's like really kind of rocking it up and he loves it. So he, at least, even though the lyrics are a bit, what the hell, he's properly going for it and giving it us with both barrels and saying, yes,
well,
here we go.
Well, the religious vibe as well, the equal people preacher line, which is...
I used to be a fisher of men.
Yeah, that fits in with what Freddie was writing at the same time, because the first album, I was surprised how many references to Jesus and obviously the track Jesus, but it's religious runs right through it, or religion runs right through it. So it's another thing why I lean to always thinking that it's by
Mercury.
I mean,
a big influence at that time was probably Jesus Christ Superstar. So you can see why they would lean towards that. Okay, that's a joke.
Really, is it? Well, I don't know. The weird thing about that is didn't Ian Gillan get the out of Deep Purple? Wasn't he the singer on the studio?
Is that right?
Was he?
Yeah. I mean, so I think weirdly, rock bands weren't, there was a kind of, I don't know, like a sort of religious thing going through a lot of bands at that time. They weren't sort of like afraid of it. It was like a sort of just thing that was there. But I think that's just true of late 60s, early 70s England. I think that it was still, you know, quite
right. So it wouldn't have been maligned. So I'm saying it now.
No, not at all. In fact, if anything, it's probably, you know, it would have been odd to call yourself an atheist back then. Still.
Yeah, interesting point.
I thought. Be really interesting to sort of open that up as a piece of maybe like ask one of my students to do it for their dissertation.
Well, I mean, Freddie was quite religious. Or no, we don't know if he was, do we? We obviously we know about the Parsi and Zoroastrian. But we don't really know if he practiced that much. That was quite a rigid religion, I think. So I don't know. I don't know what Freddie, he always strikes me as maybe spiritual, or he speaks about God a lot, but I think he always has done.
Brian does, doesn't he? Brian, if in interviews, if he's asked if he's an atheist, he always nods to a higher power, doesn't he?
What, Freddie?
Yeah. We all bow down to Freddie.
Well, actually, here's a bit that surprised me, because there's always a little bit of me that's suspicious of Brian's ego. He was the person that chose the picture for the front cover of Queen. So he sort of picked it as being, you know, Freddie is the figurehead of the band. And you think that's actually a really important statement, isn't it, at that point? That Brian and Roger, who's, you know, they were the band, and then Freddie gets himself in the band, but suddenly Freddie is elevated to, no, he is the front man. Freddie is the front man. And Brian May, acting as art director for the front cover of Queen, chooses the picture and sort of act with a statement, you know, Freddie is the front man. They obviously didn't go into it thinking that they're all equals, that Freddie was going to be the person they pushed out front.
Yeah. This was a B-side, wasn't it? Am I right?
Keep Yourself Alive, yeah.
Yeah, which I love, actually. Keep Yourself Alive is a classic, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
But what else did I read about it? That they didn't bring this, unlike in the 80s where they brought back Keep Yourself Alive and a couple of those early tracks, they didn't bring back Son and Daughter.
No. So, I mean, it was a massive live favourite. So, as I said, you know, first performed pre-Deacon in June 1970, and then 242 performances in total before it was, retired in the Hyde Park gig, the big Hyde Park gig in 1976.
I wonder if they ever hold a little ritual for the end of a song, or maybe they don't know it's the end of a song, you know, for the live.
Yeah, I wonder. No, they probably...
I think once you haven't played a song for a year, I think it's kind of, it's doomed, isn't it? But an interesting thing about Son and Daughter, of course, is that the solo section live is the Brighton Rock solo section. Mm. So it's like when you hear their live version on Live at the BBC or any of those bootlegs, he goes into that Brighton Rock guitar solo that makes its way as a studio cut on Brighton Rock. So it's like, yeah, I've got to get this on an album.
Oh, interesting. Because that was one of the things that Brian was disappointed about, that he was doing all of that stuff way, way before a lot of other guitarists, all the delays and looping type things, but he never got it on record until later. So he wasn't...
It's only a year later, isn't it?
Well, years old. It's like, as you said, though, a year's a long time in rock. Yeah. Between those years, if you think, you know, the albums.
Is
that it's
Brian May really complaining that he doesn't get enough kudos? It's ridiculous because, like, he's consistently always in the top 10 guitarists of all time polls.
Yeah. And Bohemian Rhapsody guitar solo is always up there. It's like the greatest guitar solo of all time, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's just, he's always in those polls, and he's revered by virtually all guitarists.
He just wants that as well.
I mean, there's a lot of guitarists that hate him, that kind of playing.
Who could hate Brian's playing?
I guess it's the type of player that just can't stand over-emotive playing, like your sort of bluesy guitarists that feel as though he's moved the guitar away from its kind of rightful soulful home. Which I completely fundamentally disagree with, but you can understand it. Oh, okay. Maybe Brian May is like bacon. Most people agree that it's gorgeously tasty, but there are some people who hate it.
Yeah, and I think Brian, we've kind of indicated in the past, he does a couple of things really really well, but he doesn't do everything by any stretch. So I guess if he doesn't float your boat as a guitar player, you're not going to like pretty much anything that he does. But if you like him, then you're going to like everything he does.
Yeah, do you know what? I kind of feel I might have been living in a bit of an echo chamber these last couple of months. It's hard to believe that other people don't actually think he's the greatest guitarist of all time, at all time.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Recently, because obviously when as a child, he was literally my favourite guitar player. It's the reason why I played guitar. I did get into other guitarists more. So I do... I actually do have more favourite guitarists, but coming back to this Queen project and then going, oh no, actually Brian May is actually amazing. There's so many, he's got so many good bits in there.
Yeah.
You know, he's just one of the greatest guitar players of all time, and it's not the only great guitar
player. If there is a criticism of him, it's like he's absolutely brilliant at that. But he's no, like, you couldn't compare him to Steve Howe for Steve Howe's sheer versatility across stringed instruments, for instance.
Or Robert Fripp, or Ingrid Malmsteen, or Steve Vai. You know, as soon as someone like Steve Vai and Eddie Van Halen came along, he does seem a little bit old-fashioned. Mm. He can't really keep up with that kind of newer breed of guitarist. Yeah. And then you've got, and then it's like when it comes to rocking out, and you've got Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine, he can't really compete with that, can he? So, and you can understand
it. In a way, it's a little bit similar with Roger Taylor as well. I mean, Roger's the greatest drummer of all time in my mind, but there's no real objective argument to say that he's technically superior to Neil Peart. You can't really put that case forward, but you can say that he's a better song drummer and definitely more rock and roll, you know, and kind of more fun to watch almost.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's all silly, isn't it, really? That whole who's better than who.
Yeah.
It's a very silly argument, but I think all the members of Queen on the whole are so fantastic for playing for the actual song itself, which is one of the reasons why they're a rock band full of, you know, virtuoso musicianship that are really a pop band as well. And you can't say that about virtually any other band. You know, like if you got Rush, they're not a pop band. That, you know, people only listen to them who are, you know, rock fans. They've written a couple of great pop songs, but not chart smashers like Queen do.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, they're just in a different league. Queen are in a different league to that because they can do both.
Yeah. And with Queen, it's the sum of the parts is by far greater than any individual when they come together. Just it's off the scale, isn't it?
Yeah. So, say if you had the Beatles were the sort of prototype of Queen, then Queen in the 70s, who would you say was then the band that take the mantle from Queen? And if you say Muse, I will come round your house and kill you.
Yeah, yeah. I'd
say, from what period? From the 80s or the 90s?
Yeah, you can have several bands, but yeah, what if there a band in the 80s that sort of go off and do that kind of really high musicianship but very poppy? And, you know, have songwriting at their very core.
Yeah, there'd be an argument for U2 or REM, possibly. Mm. You know, very, very songy.
Radiohead? Or are they too... The Radiohead, their second album.
Yeah, it's a bit experimental. Yeah, the first and second albums, or maybe the first three, but... Is there anyone? Because who can play the stadiums? But I suppose those bands can.
I think Ian's right. I think maybe it is the U2s, and then maybe now it's Coldplay.
Yeah, because not that hard to play their stuff, but it's very effective at what it does. And you know, you've got to hand it to both U2 and Coldplay. They've got some catchy tunes.
Yeah, it's funny that the Beatles, Queen, Radiohead, Coldplay are all on the same label.
Mm.
We're all on Parlophone.
Yeah, well, crikey.
That's a good label.
Going to the rest of their catalogue, yeah, absolutely.
I don't think either of those quite follow on in the same way, but I'm not sure how or why. So I'll be coming back at you at another podcast on that one.
You know, you can see that progression from Beatles to Queen, but it is hard to see what Queen then go into, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's no undermine my argument there. There's no humour at all with U2, and very little humour with Coldplay as well. There's no, you know, looking at us, we're all in this laughing together, having a good time, which there always was with Queen.
Yeah. Oh, well, and with the Beatles as well.
Yeah.
Like the Beatles, Queen, I've got that kind of English English self-deprecation and fun about
them. Squeeze aren't quite big enough. They've got the English
squeeze.
they've got the hits though. They've got the tunes,
they're not quite. Yeah, they're not
quite big enough. Same with XTC as well. You could.
I was going to say XTC are actually quite good, or Tears for Fears, or maybe they're too serious.
Yeah.
Duran Duran.
But it's the range as well, isn't it? You're not thinking about the range here, of the depth of what they're able, what Queen are able to do, what genres are able to go to successfully.
Mm. Yeah. No, there's no one that's...
It's hard, isn't it? It's a hard one.
Done it.
Yeah, we'll have to put a pin in it. Maybe people will tweet us and let us know what they reckon is the lineage of Queen. Beatles, Queen, what next? Well, not what next after that?
Yeah.
Cool. So we've obviously done on Son and Daughter.
Son and Daughter. What else is there to say?
Well, I was going to say it was good fun. You know, good fun to play. Relatively straightforward. I mean, it's very high. The the Roger bits, as ever, very difficult to do those bits. But the rest of it's fairly stock. But it does have that weird ending where it's all kind of thundering along. Quite nicely, the big heavy ploddy song, and then it changes gear.
Loads of harmony guitars.
Harmony guitars, it's kind of descending.
It's Brian's
thing.
Showy offy bit, isn't it?
Yeah, and really? It kind of does it go up a note? It goes an ascending chord pattern, and then gets faster and faster, and then kind of fades out a bit. I just didn't understand. I would have thought just do a big rock and roll finish on it.
Yeah, but I think live it goes into the Brighton Rock solo, and they didn't want to do that on this. For a debut album, are probably a little bit too boring. But it's the start of that Brian May using the bass pedal note and doing lots of stuff over the top harmonically, which he does. You know, we've mentioned this before. He does that quite a lot. So it's obviously he just loves doing it. That's his thing.
Yeah.
That's his little musical motif. And it is there all the way through their career. I think... Son and Daughter, despite it being a bit of a kind of also-ran track, is an incredibly important one. It sets the template for the sort of Queen heavy metal songs.
Yeah.
And it also brings in a lot of the ideas that will resurface in a much better format on other songs later on in their career.
Yeah. It you could understand the criticism of the Led Zeppelin comparison that was rife, as we said earlier, with that. And they never went there again, really. Well, maybe until the Innuendo track.
I was going to say Innuendo is just the biggest nod, isn't it, to Zeppelin?
Yeah.
I just think this is way more like Black Sabbath than Led Zeppelin. I mean, the Led Zeppelin, like the guitar and bass playing the same riff, Led Zeppelin had done that the year before, and I can't remember what track it was.
Yeah, and as you say, Freddie is doing a bit of a Robert Plant, isn't he, on those?
But it is definitely the sort of heaviness of the riff and the sort of the way that it plods through. See, Zeppelin were way more bluesy and groovy than that, whereas Black Sabbath had sort of invented this kind of real, proper, grungy dirge. Yeah, and that's what this references more than Zeppelin. I think it's got a lot more with Sabbath, common in Sabbath.
Mm.
And which is not a bad thing. You know, those early Sabbath albums are like insanely good.
Yeah, yeah.
Shall we have a listen to your version then, Ian?
Well, here it is. Son and Daughter.
Whoa!